Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. On Thursdays, we like to have a focus on technology, and today we're talking about biotechnology. The House Agriculture Subcommittee on Livestock and Foreign Agriculture, as well as the Subcommittee on Biotechnology, Horticulture, and Research, held a joint hearing this week to examine applications and advancements in biotechnology. Representative Jim Costa of California led the meeting as the chair of the Livestock Subcommittee.
Good morning to everyone again. I want to thank both Chairwoman Plaskett and members Johnson and Baird and other subcommittee members from both subcommittees. We know that biotechnology is a critical subject with lots of potential in solving some of our most pressing issues as we try to ensure that we maintain our competitiveness in terms of trade, but investing in research and streamlining our regulatory system to help facilitate what America has traditionally done, which is, I think, led the world in terms of the transformation of our ability to produce food and fiber in the most nutritious fashion, at the most cost-effective way, that has allowed us not only to feed our nation for all American consumers every day, but also to allow us to export to feed parts of the world. And we know that with climate change, these challenges become greater. And I like to harken back to, we're talking a lot about infrastructure here the last several months and how we invest in America's infrastructure. And, you know, when you talk about agriculture and we remember our history, two meaningful pieces of legislation were signed a long time ago when President Lincoln was trying to keep the country together during the Civil War, maybe perhaps our most divided moment in America's history. And on July 1st, he signed the act that created the Transcontinental Railroad to bind the nation from coast to coast. But the very next day, July 2nd, he signed the Mallory Act that created land-grant universities. And I think that is not traditionally seen as infrastructure, but land-grant universities have been part of America's ability to maintain its cutting edge in technology and how much that has transformed our ability to be so successful. Throughout our history, farmers have researched ways to optimize their ability to produce livestock and crop production. And over the past few decades, but even further back, going back to the development of our land-grant university system, working with the private sector, we've been able to figure out ways to grow more sustainable food at a faster rate. And therefore, it's, I think, incumbent upon us as policymakers to ensure that we take advantage of the latest cutting-edge technology, because with climate change, we know just last week, the Department of Defense highlighted 13 countries in the world in which water allocation is going to be so critical that their ability to maintain stability in those countries is going to be a question mark. And so, whether it's biotechnology, more drought-resistant plants, or whether it's technologies to use water more efficiently, are all part of what we have to do. The staggering drought that we're having in the West is a reflection of these changes in climate. And in California, we're seeing drought conditions that we've not seen since 76 and 77. And so I'm very familiar as a third generation farmer in California with the consequences. So I'm very interested in the innovative solutions that the panel will provide today. The testimony of our witnesses, I think, provides us opportunities to learn of new technological advancements in light of climate change and how we optimize the use of our water. As we like to say in California, where water flows, food grows. So while I believe we must address the underlying problems that are involved in climate change, and we're hoping to do that as a part of this infrastructure package, we also need to begin to adapt to other changing conditions. And we need to look at the experts on how we can do a better job down the horizon. Whether we're talking about at home or abroad, changing populations and straining our food systems, we see how supply chain shocks impact our ability to put food on America's dinner table. when you close restaurants and schools as we did last spring, you take a complex, complicated food supply chain and you turn it upside down. And we're still dealing with the consequences of that. And then we see, obviously we must strengthen supply chains. When we see the circumstances in our ports and harbors and the bottlenecks that have taken place in recent months, how more difficult it is, in fact, to make that supply chain operate in a way that reflects our needs of our country and who we trade with around the world. So there's a lot of impacts here. There's a lot of complexity. And I think this hearing will help us focus on a number of these issues. I look forward again to hearing with the four experts that bring a wealth of knowledge in biotechnology and agriculture. Their testimony will provide important information. So now I'd like to defer to the ranking member from South Dakota, Mr. Johnson, for any opening remarks that he would like to give. And then our subcommittee chair from wonderful U.S. Virgin Islands, Stacy Plaskett, will have her opening statement with her ranking member as well. So Representative Johnson from South Dakota, please, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And I agree with Ms. Plaskett. It is good to see GT and good to see you looking well, Mr. Ranking Member. I think it's good we're doing this hearing together because clearly technological advances, innovation, they have had a tremendous impact on livestock and on horticulture. And we're going to get a lot more done together than we would separately. So thank you to both chairmen for making this happen. There is a moral and a technological issue that's facing this committee and society. How are we going to feed a growing world at the same time that we work to be good stewards of our environment? I suspect you all know the numbers. The United Nations Population Division expects there'll be nearly 10 billion people on this planet by the year 2050. And we are called to feed the world. And we're not going to do that. We're not going to succeed without innovation, without technology. Embracing innovation and technology, we will increase weight gain, we'll increase yields, we'll reduce our carbon footprint, we'll improve animal welfare. And again, we're only going to do these things by embracing ingenuity, progress, and innovation. And agriculture has a positive story to tell. It is innovation that has allowed our producers to produce more food with fewer resources. And certainly livestock producers in South Dakota and elsewhere have been doing that by adopting things like genetically enhanced EPDs, IVF, and embryo transfer, as well as extensive artificial insemination to increase profitability and the efficiency of the genetics, which are so critically important. But the technology is advancing even further, though. We have a tendency so often when we're talking about technological improvements in ag to focus on crops, and there has been a lot there. But I would tell you that the pace of change is accelerating on the livestock side as well. From disease-resistant pigs to polled Holstein cattle, these innovations have the potential to vastly improve the production landscape. So I look forward to hearing from our panel on what is and what is not working with our current laws and regulations. For example, where we stand on efforts like the implementation of bioengineering food disclosure standard and views on how the coordinated framework can and should be applied to GE livestock and any other evolving regulatory hurdles. Making progress on these issues will also require an international approach. And Madam Chairman and Mr. Chairman, as I close, let's just be frank. There are too many in this world who cast doubts on science as a tool. And they actively lobby international institutions to adopt their anti-innovation agenda. And I look forward to working with this committee in a bipartisan way to ensure that the United States maintains a science-driven regulatory system and that we actively advocate that position abroad. That's going to mean a lot of consumer education. It's also going to mean working through trade agreements and relationships so that we can maintain internationally a predictability on standards that our producers need to feed the world and be good stewards of the environment. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I look forward to working with you and all others on the committee on these issues. Thank you, and I yield back.
Well, I thank the gentleman, and I couldn't agree with you more. I think that a strong science-based regulatory framework is what we need to do to have an international standard that we can all comply with. I think phytosanitary standards, not only in this country but around the world, need to be shared and respected. But I feel that way on all bases. I think public health needs to be science-based as well, and I just get very frustrated when I see some people ignoring the importance and the success that science has allowed us to make such important progress on. Having said that, I am so excited to have our subcommittee chair, Ms. Plaskett from the U.S. Virgin Islands, who's I've had the pleasure to work with over the years, and she chairs the Biotechnology, Horticulture, and Research Subcommittee for opening remarks that I know that she has. And Ms. Plaskett, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This looks to be a very informative hearing today as we discuss the advancements and application, of agricultural biotechnology. Thank you, Mr. Costa, Chair of the Subcommittee on Livestock and Foreign Agriculture Subcommittee, for your in convening this hearing and sharing your expertise. This sort of collaboration will help us all view our work on the Agriculture Committee through a broader lens and facilitate more holistic conversations as we look ahead to the next Farm Bill. Today's hearing will be an opportunity for members to learn and evaluate the regulatory framework of agriculture biotechnology and engage with experts in plant and animal agricultural innovation. I look forward to hearing updates on innovation coming down the pipeline, as well as what we on the Agriculture Committee can be doing to ensure these innovations are getting into the right hands to produce more resilient food supply and generate opportunities in our agriculture communities. I would like to highlight the exciting research that's going on in my district in the University of the Virgin Islands Agricultural Experiment Station and working on phytobiotechnology research in traditional Caribbean crops such as papaya, passion fruit, pineapple, cassava, sweet potato varieties, and more. This important research is working to develop varieties of crops that are disease resistant, better adapted to local soil types, and provide a multiple of other benefits. I would also like to at this time submit for unanimous consent the following letter by the Agricultural Stakeholders Community for the record.
Hearing no opposition, the information will deem accepted.
Thank you. Again, I look forward to having an informative and productive dialogue today and to working with the chair and both ranking members here as we continue this discussion. With that, Mr. Chairman, I yield back.
We have more from the hearing in segment 3. Our news brief is up next. We'll be right back.
Agromiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R almond, grizzly walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and platinum clonal pistachio rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. Does your crop have iron chlorosis? Agroplante has a solution for you. Traditionally, chelated iron has limitations that Agroplante's Iron Force does not. Iron Force, with its EDDHA chelation technology, can turn your plant's iron chlorosis from yellow to green in as little as 15 days, despite unbalanced soil pH and calcareous soils. From organic certified to conventional micronutrients, Agroplante has the product for you. Call 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplante.com. Network with the top tier of the industry at this year's California TreeNut Conference. featuring presentations from the top executives from CDFA and California's tree nut commodity boards. Register at WCNGG.com, and we'll see you in Tulare on November 3rd at the California Tree Nut Conference.
Welcome back. Here's our news for today. Just before a recent atmospheric river storm hit California, Governor Gavin Newsom expanded California's drought emergency. The California Farm Bureau is reporting that experts say the rains, including a record single-day rainfall in Sacramento on October 24th, are not enough to end the two-year drought. Newsom said California needs to brace itself for an anticipated third year of drought. He said, quote, "It's critical that Californians across the state redouble our efforts to save water." The California Department of Food and Agriculture is now accepting applications for Climate Smart Agriculture Technical Assistance Program funding. They're trying to ensure that there are technical assistance providers available to provide outreach to farmers and ranchers about the Alternative Manure Management Program. Funds awarded through the competitive grant process will be distributed to several eligible entities and throughout the state to assist farmers and ranchers in applying to that program and provide continued assistance during project implementation. Eligible grant entities include resource conservation districts, University of California Cooperative Extension, and nonprofit organizations which demonstrate technical expertise. The high price of fuel is supporting profitability on the farm and at the ethanol plant. Todd Gleason asked Kansas State University Extension Ag economist Dan O'Brien how the price of crude oil and gasoline are supporting corn.
Well, we certainly have an uptrend. And some would call it inflation. Some would call it profitability. But CME light, Chicago Mercantile Exchange light crude oil spot price closed up to yesterday. Well, it's at 83.76. Gasoline price at 2.44, and those are all in strong uptrends from where they've been. An uptrend basically from all the way back in April, May of last year. There've been some. There was a little bit of a downtrend this summer from during June, July, August, but it started back with a strong at least a 45-degree angle going to the higher side. So all that is the futures are indicating strong demand for what oil, gasoline supplies are out there. At the retail side, retail diesel prices as of October 25th, coming out of the U.S. Energy Information Administration, at $3.71 per gallon, gasoline at $3.47.6. So almost all states that have any type of that have large urban population centers are all showing pretty high prices. You and I were talking before we came on air. There is one state apparently that still is below $3. What did you say that was, Todd?
That, according to Gas Buddy, is Oklahoma.
Oklahoma. So and why would that be? Well, probably the presence of it's probably a logistical issue in terms of the presence of supplies and processors and all of that. So just interesting as all get out. Ethanol production, based on reports from the industry of a pretty strong profitability, ethanol production doing pretty well. At usage at a rate that would bring us close to corn usage for ethanol plants of about 5.25 to 5.4 billion bushels. And yet the USDA's usage last year for corn for ethanol is 5.032 billion bushels. Here they projected 5.2. And you look at that and you think, well, they're being optimistic. But yet you look at the pace that we've had so far in this marketing year since September 1. And without an adjustment down, we'd be at 5.25 to 5.4. From a Kansas and Illinois corn producers' perspective, that's great news, in that the underlying source of demand for corn usage, along with, of course, livestock feeding and exports and wet corn milling, but about a third or so of usage is really doing pretty well. So I guess we have this horse race going on right now in agriculture between the the increased price of ethanol on the one hand, and decent prices for corn on the other, and the hand-wringing issue of what the increased price of our inputs are for the next year that could affect us in terms of our ability to plant all the acres that we need to meet this pretty good demand. So it's kind of the quandary that we're in.
Is there a difference between ethanol in Illinois at the plant and the price of corn and that in Kansas at the plant?
Well, the latest USDA daily ethanol report as of Monday, October 25th, that I have in hand, showed the top end price in Illinois for corn at the plants, $5.58, and that's above the Kansas top end at $5.43. Illinois had a range of $5.03 to $5.58, Kansas $5.33 to $5.43. You do see on the distillers' grains market that the presence of our livestock feeding sector out here in this western states area has given us a pretty strong dried distillers' grains price, $255 a ton, and at Illinois it's at $195. So still great prices, but having the livestock feeders located a mile outside your door of your plant makes a big difference in that market.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and National Marine Fisheries Service seek to rescind two critical habitat regulations finalized in the last days of the Trump administration. In December of 2020, FWS issued a final rule that revised the process for considering critical habitat exclusions under the Endangered Species Act. FWS re-evaluated the rule and concluded the conservation purposes of the ESA are better met by resuming its previous approach. The proposal follows an executive order which directed all federal agencies to review and address agency actions to ensure consistency with Biden administration objectives. But the American Farm Bureau Federation calls the effort a disappointment. Rural counties last month saw more cases of COVID-19 than their urban and suburban counterparts. Michael Clements reports.
As farmers and ranchers are busy this fall, they don't exactly have time to be sick. There's crops to harvest, livestock to care for, and community events, all equally important to rural communities. Dr. Neil Koo, hospital epidemiologist and medical director of infection control and antimicrobial stewardship at Billings Clinic in Billings, Montana, says your risk of getting COVID-19 or even dying from COVID-19 are higher than those in urban settings.
Seems that rural areas, the rural counties, had higher rates of COVID-19 than their urban counterparts this September. And the deaths due to COVID-19 of the rural Americans are currently twice the rate of people in the urban areas. And roughly about 35% of rural Americans are unvaccinated. That is 10% more of their urban and suburban counterparts.
He says your best chance to protect yourself and your community is to get vaccinated.
The more people who are vaccinated, the more effective vaccination is to protect not just you, but your families, loved ones, friends, and members of the community from getting acutely ill from COVID-19 and subsequently requiring to be hospitalized. If you haven't gotten vaccinated, it's much more readily available than it was 8-9 months ago.
And getting vaccinated, Dr. Koo says, is not just a decision that affects you.
It's not just something that's just for the person who received the vaccine. In general, vaccination is a public health tool, really, to help with the spread of several infectious diseases. I think it's very important for us to consider that it's not just the person that you as an individual, whether you choose to do it or not, the benefits or consequences would just be solely to be the decider. That the decision really affects the people that you're around, everyone in your household, as well as everyone in your community.
While you may hear of breakthrough cases or adverse reactions to the vaccine, Dr. Koo says those events are rare.
The general public's perception of vaccination is that the vaccinated person is assumed to be impervious to the infection. The goal of vaccination, at least for COVID-19, is to try to reduce the incidence or the likelihood of someone developing COVID-19 with symptoms that's severe enough that will lead them to be hospitalized or, worst case scenario, die from COVID-19. This vaccine is very safe. There are always going to be some reported adverse reaction. And now we have had more than 200 million doses of vaccine given. The incidence of an adverse effect related to vaccine has just been very low.
Dr. Koo encourages rural residents to talk with their healthcare provider to learn more about the vaccine.
I think the best way that for rural residents to learn more about the vaccine is to talk to your doctor. or pharmacists or any healthcare professionals that you trust. And finally, the best way to find out where you can get your vaccine is visiting vaccines.gov. And a few simple questions will direct you to the nearest vaccination site. Many of those places either will take appointments or walk in. So they make it as convenient as possible for you to get your vaccine.
Again, visit vaccines.gov to learn more and find out where to get vaccinated in your area. Michael Clements reporting.
USDA's National Institute of Food and Agriculture Wednesday announced $25 million for 50 grants supporting farm and ranch stress assistance network State Department of Agriculture projects. Long before the pandemic caused an increase in stress around the world, stress-related mental health was already a rising concern across farm communities coast to coast. USDA NIFA introduced a competitive grants program, the Farm and Ranch Stress Assistance Network, reauthorized by the 2018 Farm Bill, which supports projects that provide stress assistance for people in agriculture. Funded projects must initiate, expand, or sustain programs that provide professional agricultural behavioral health counseling and referral for other forms of assistance as necessary. That's our news for today. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Welcome back. We continue now with the discussion on biotechnology. Dr. Fanli Chow is the Vice President of Scientific Affairs and Policy with the American Seed Trade Association. She is one of the featured witnesses at the House Ag Committee hearing. Congressman Jim Costa gave her introduction.
So with those opening statements concluded, we now move into the real purpose of the hearing, and that's to listen to some of the distinguished guests that we have who are experts in their field. We have four witnesses on the panel this morning, and we want to thank them for their time and their efforts to provide their presentation to the two subcommittees. Let us begin with our first witness, Dr. Fanli Chow, who is the Vice President of Scientific Affairs and Policy for the American Seed and Trade Association. Remember to keep your mics muted, my fellow colleagues, because it works a lot better that way unless you're recognized. So without further ado, Dr. Fanli Chow, we look forward to hearing your comments this morning. And you have 5 minutes, and the clock will begin on your opening statement.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairwoman Plaskett, Chairman Costa, Ranking Member Thompson, Ranking Member Bard, and Ranking Member Johnson, and the members of the subcommittee. I am so pleased to be here representing AFTA's nearly 700 member companies at today's hearing. Our members produce everything from grass and turf seed to row crop seed, to vegetable and ornamental seed, to true potato seed for conventional, genetic engineered, and organic seed markets. AFTA has been around since 1883. So as we consider the current advances in agricultural biotechnology and look forward to the applications in the 21st century, I think it's worthwhile to reflect on the common thread that runs from 1883 to now. And that common thread is plant breeding. So plant breeding has been around since our ancestors domesticated crops. But in the last several decades, plant scientists and plant breeders have accumulated an impressive collection of tools to unlock the genetic potential of plant crops. And using these tools, we have safely and reliably introduced into the food system hundreds of thousands of new plant varieties over the last century. In the 21st century, we are all facing critical challenges to our agricultural food system: climate change, a rapidly growing global population, environmental degradation. The need for new, improved plant variety is more pressing than ever. But thankfully, plant breeders have an unprecedented number of tools to drive solutions. The most exciting of late is gene editing. So in agriculture, gene editing is an enabling tool. It supports rather than supplants the fundamentals of plant breeding. It enables our plant breeders to leverage the decades of accumulated scientific discoveries and understanding of plant genetics to increase the accuracy, the precision, and the efficiency of plant breeding. Gene editing is being used across all crops, including specialty crops, and by breeding programs of all sizes, including public universities and small companies. We're using gene editing to work within the plant's genetic family, similar to what is done to what's done in conventional breeding or can occur in nature. So let me share a few examples. So non-brownie varieties are being developed for fruits and vegetables like potatoes, avocados, and lettuce. For potatoes alone, non-brownie varieties could eliminate 1.5 billion pounds of wasted potatoes. We're working on water-efficient crops from lettuce to wheat to rice. We're using gene editing to discover cover crops that can be cash crops, bringing both environmental and economic benefits. It's used to encourage healthy eating, modifying soybeans so it's heart healthy, to make berries more consistent and more available to consumers. And many of these examples are based on public and private partnerships. But whether these examples and others like them and the tremendous benefits they can provide becomes widely available would depend in part on research investment and more notably on the policy and regulatory environment in the US and around the world. ASTA, we commend the regulatory improvement that USDA has made in its final rule for biotech regulation that was published in May 2020. That final rule recognizes the longstanding safety record associated with plant breeding and exempts certain types of plants that could have been done through conventional breeding or occur through nature. And we look forward to working with USDA to implementing the various elements of that final rule. We also appreciate the proposed rule by EPA, and we look forward to the leadership by EPA's administrator in getting that rule to the finish line. Finally, we are awaiting clarifying guidance from FDA. It is critical that these three agencies are consistent and coordinated in their policy approach. In closing, the 21st century is looking right at us. We're in the middle of it. We have the tools to develop solutions to the challenges facing our food system. But to ensure those tools are widely accessible across all crops, across operations of all sizes, production methods, and geographies, it is important to maintain strong investment in plant breeding research and for domestic and international policies to be clear, risk-based, risk-proportionate, science-based, and harmonized. Otherwise, innovation would be limited to a very, very few crop varieties, and the benefits will never be fully realized across a broad agricultural sector. I really appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts with you today, and I'll be happy to take any questions, and I look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Fanley-Chow, and I like your screensaver. It's a nice backdrop. But we now move on to our next witness today, Dr. Alea, Chief Scientific Officer for Genus PLC. Dr. Rice, please begin with your opening statement. The time clock there. We look forward to hearing your comments.
Chairman Costa, Chairwoman Plaskett, and ranking members Thompson, Johnson, and Baird, and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Elena Rice, and I'm the Chief Scientific Officer of Genus PLC. I also serve on the board of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization's Agriculture and Environment Governing Board. I'm honored to testify before you today to discuss how innovation in animal breeding will help to protect our food supply, feed our growing population, and create more healthy and sustainable food system. Genus PLC is a world-leading animal genetics company. We're breeding better pigs and cattle so farmers can produce high-quality meat and milk more efficiently and sustainably. Genus has a long history of leadership in research, development, and delivering porcine and bovine genetics. And we apply new ideas using gene editing, reproductive biology, and other breeding technologies to improve genetics for sustainable production and healthier and disease-resistant animals. Genesis R&D and ABS, our global bovine business, have headquarters in DeForest, Wisconsin, and PIC, our global porcine business, has headquarters in Nashville, Tennessee. Our firm belief is we need more science to improve animal health and welfare and continue America's leadership in meeting global protein demand. Additionally, as climate change and zoonotic diseases present even greater risk today to animal and human health and to our economy, more science is urgently needed to find mitigating solutions. I appreciate the opportunity to appear today because the innovative work being done by Genus and others in the biotechnology and livestock industry is so critical. Due to science and technology, we see livestock genetics, along with industry practices, reducing animals' carbon footprint. For example, the amount of feed needed for a pig to build body weight has fallen by nearly 60% over the last 50 years. In dairy, 13% fewer cows today, producing 76% more milk. Put simply, the animal footprint in the United States is going down, and in large part, this is due to improved knowledge and application of innovative animal practices, science, and technology. Beyond these benefits, we've seen even greater opportunity in the prevention of disease. Through Genesis Gene Editing Program, we have an opportunity today to eradicate porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome, or PRRS virus. PRRS is a global endemic disease which causes animal death and suffering, which impacts the livelihood of all farmers. We're excited to share that through a small deletion in one gene and not a single addition to the pig genome, in our research trials, PRRS-resistant pigs showed complete resistance, and I mean 100% resistance, to the PRRS virus. The product is currently going through regulatory review by the FDA. As this committee notes in your letter to USDA and FDA, an efficient risk and science-based regulatory system is imperative to capitalizing on this solution, and we agree. For Genus, our ethical commitments guide our efforts, including our commitment to partner and comply with all global government regulations, including testing and safety requirements. However, to bring these solutions to commercial reality, we need practical, less expensive, risk and science-based regulatory system that provides safe and predictable path to market. We believe a fit-for-purpose regulatory framework for animals should create certainty for innovators, investors, producers, and consumers. And it should be practical in allowing the benefits of the technology to be efficiently and safely realized, while at the same time cementing the US as a pioneer in innovation in this sector. We also need a coordinated global regulatory framework to avoid trade disruption and allowing producers and farmers to embrace these solutions. In closing, as we look to the future, we truly believe new technologies can lead to eradication of animal diseases, provide the opportunity for less use of antibiotics, produce more protein from fewer animals, resulting to less environmental impact. If these innovations are stifled, society will miss out on huge solutions for improving the sustainability of our food system. Thank you. I look forward to your questions.
I want to thank you, Dr. Rice, for your concise testimony, informative testimony, and both witnesses for staying within the timeline. So we appreciate it.
We'll have more from the hearing right after this.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236. Or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Welcome back. We conclude now the House Agriculture Subcommittee hearing to examine applications and advancements in biotechnology.
I now defer to our subcommittee chair, Chairwoman Plaskett, to introduce our third panel member, Subcommittee Chairman Plaskett. Floor
is yours. Thank you very much. Today is Mr. Jack Bobo, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Fortuity. Thank you so much, Mr. Bobo, for being a part of the hearing today and for sharing your expertise and knowledge and supporting the work of our subcommittees. Thank you, and you have 5 minutes now.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairwoman Plaskett, Chairman Costa, Ranking Member Baird, Ranking Member Johnson, and members of the subcommittee for having me here today. As was mentioned, I'm Jack Bobo, the CEO of Fortuity, a food foresight company. However, I previously served for 4 years as the Chief Communications Officer for Intrexon Corporation, a synthetic biology company. While you may not be familiar with the Intrexon name, you're likely familiar with some of the company's products, which included the non-browning Arctic apple, genetically engineered mosquitoes, animal clones. I also served on the board of Aqua Bounty Technologies. Before that, I served for 12 years with the U.S. Department of State as the senior advisor for global biotechnology under 4 secretaries and during 2 administrations. I'm pleased to be here today to talk about agricultural biotechnology, 21st century advancements and applications. There can be no more important topic than the future of agriculture, because the future of the planet depends on the food we eat and the choices we make about that food over the next 3 decades. The impact of agriculture on the planet is enormous in terms of land, water, and climate change. And unfortunately, as was already mentioned, things are going to get worse before they get better, because we need to produce 50 to 60% more food by the year 2050. Transforming the food system to be more sustainable and resilient provides one of the best opportunities to make change for the better. My remarks here today focus on agricultural biotechnology in contributing to a more sustainable, just, and nutritious future, not because it is a silver bullet, but because it's an important tool. Let me share a couple of examples. The most popular fruit in the world today is the banana. However, the most common variety, the Cavendish, is at risk of extinction from plant disease. Biotech research currently underway in the United States and overseas has the potential to save this variety, and it's critical that these products be able to make it to market. They also have impacts on smallholder farmers around the world. Similar benefits will accrue from the deployment of animal biotech products such as the Aqua Advantage salmon, which would add jobs domestically and reduce U.S. dependence on $3 billion of salmon imports. Globally, the picture is quite diverse. We see some countries forging ahead with deployment of genetically engineered and gene-edited products, while others continue to put in place regulatory barriers to adoption. In Asia, Japan has traditionally taken a cautious approach to ag biotech. However, the country took a great leap forward this year with the placing on the market of the first plant and animal gene-edited products, a tomato with a healthier nutrient profile and a meatier fish. Japanese regulations allow such products to be marketed without the regulatory hoops required of a genetically engineered food product, though they must be registered with the Ministry of Health. Unfortunately, consumer acceptance of ag biotech continues to lag behind the global consensus among regulators in the safety of products currently on the market, as well as confidence in the technology from the scientific community. The United States has long held a comfortable lead in the development and application of new biotech products, but that leadership is now in doubt. This can be seen in the recent advances in Japan in the case of gene editing. It is also on display in other areas of food technology, such as cell-cultured and cell-cultivated meat, with governments in Singapore and Israel giving the green light to products ahead of U.S. regulatory agencies, despite the long history and the long lead time in terms of technology development here in the United States. In conclusion, innovation is the only way to produce 50% more food using less land and water and while dramatically reducing emissions. Agriculture has a long history of reducing impact while increasing output. In order to see even greater gains over the next 30 years, we must prioritize investments in agriculture and development of policies that promote more sustainable outcomes. This will ensure that the United States remains the global leader in technology development and, most importantly, provides leadership to the rest of the world to follow suit. Thank you for providing me the opportunity to discuss this critical topic. I look forward to the questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bobel. Our fourth witness that will complete our panel and will begin the 5 minutes for each member for questions and comments is Dr. John Oatley, who is the Associate Dean of Research and the Professor of the School of Molecular Biosciences and Molecular and Functional Genomics Initiative, College of Veterinary Medicine at Washington State University. Dr. Oatley, that's a mouthful. But clearly, Washington State is one of our premier universities in the country, and your leadership as the Associate Dean is well-respected, and we look forward to hearing your comments.
Good morning, Chairman Costa, Chairwoman Plaskett, Ranking Members Johnson, Baird, and Thompson, Congresswoman Trier from Washington State, and other members of the subcommittees. My name is John Oatley. I am the Associate Dean of Research and a professor in the College of Veterinary Medicine at Washington State University. My testimony will reflect how I see the current state of biotechnology in animal agriculture, in particular, the potential for gene editing technologies to improve how the human population is fed now and in the coming decades. The lens I see this area through has been shaped by an array of experiences. Beyond serving as a research administrator for a Tier 1 land-grant university, I'm also a scientist working at the ground level to develop gene editing applications in farm animals. I've also gained an academician's perspective on early-stage navigation of the current federal regulatory approval process for biotechnology in animals, and I served as a member of the recent task force on gene editing in livestock that was established by the American Association of Veterinary Medical Colleges and Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities. As has been mentioned several times already, food security is a global issue. At present, nearly 1 billion people are malnourished and in starvation conditions. And based on historic trend, the human population is estimated to reach 10 billion by the year 2050. That's a 28% increase from where we are today. Although opinions vary, most scientists agree that a significant increase somewhere in the neighborhood of 60% will be needed in agricultural production, both plant and animal. And that's just to maintain today's nutritional standards for feeding the future in 2050. The farm animal of the future will need to be more efficient in converting inputs such as feed and water into outputs for human consumption. And it will need to do this in increasingly harsher environments while having less impact on the climate. We will need to tailor food animals for feeding more with less. And now is the time to start the process, not years from now. Humans have been engineering the genome of domesticated animals for thousands of years by way of selective breeding. But it's really the last 10 years of scientific discovery that have been a game changer through advent of gene editing as a molecular tool for precision genome engineering and creating dramatic positive impact on production traits. We are already starting to see applications be advanced from the research lab into commercial channels, including strategies to make PRRS-resistant pigs that were developed by scientists at the University of Missouri and the Roslin Institute, and surrogate sires breeding technology that was developed at Washington State University that is designed to amplify the impact of desirable or elite genetics across the spectrum of livestock production. Global adoption of innovation for producing agricultural animals can significantly strengthen the food supply and positively impact economic prosperity. Applications of gene editing to enhance traits is the present and the future of innovation in livestock production. For the promises to be realized in feeding the future, processes for federal regulatory approval and monitoring must be rooted in science and aligned to the pace of development. The current U.S. federal regulatory framework that governs process of intentional genetic alteration of animals was designed for molecular technologies of more than three decades ago and is not well aligned with state-of-the-art for gene editing. A modernization is needed that likely includes re-envisioning of agencies that approve and monitor applications in food animals. To this end, I believe the advance notice of proposed rulemaking on the regulation of animals developed by genetic engineering that was released by the USDA in 2020 and the MOU created in 2021 by officials of the USDA and HHS that calls for collaboration between the FDA and USDA in establishing a coordinated framework to assess genetic alteration in food animals and streamline the approval and monitoring processes are both steps in the right direction. I urge Congress to consider modernizing federal regulatory framework of gene editing in food animals and to be judicious with enacting it. We have the tools at our disposal for designing the farm animal of the future that will feed more with less. We now need a federal regulatory landscape that is conducive for making material gains in advancing discoveries from laboratory to the public domain. I'd like to close by paraphrasing a quote from George Washington that was written in a letter in 1794. I know of no pursuit in which more real and important services can be rendered to any country than by improving its agriculture and its breeding of useful animals. A statement was relevant 227 years ago, and I believe it still rings true today in guiding the next frontier of animal agriculture. And that will undoubtedly involve applications of gene editing. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before this panel.
That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.